Hello, and welcome to Boss Madel, where I sit down and get real with some pretty amazing, creative women entrepreneurs. So grab yourself a cup of coffee or a glass of wine and get ready to be inspired. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 14th episode of Boss Madel. Today, I sit down with Dr. Mimi Knoll. She is a board-certified radiation oncologist and a busy mom, and we talk about her numerous roles and her important work in the medical field. And before we dive right into the interview, I just want to talk a little bit about balance. I often ask my guests, you know, how do you balance it all? And many guests have responded, well, that's a loaded question. And the truth is, after reading Rachel Hollis's new book, Girl, Stop Apologizing, I mean, I agreed before, but I agree even more now that balance can be sometimes a bit of a dirty word. It, in fact, according to Rachel, can be a bit of a myth. So she writes, it's a hurtful myth because I don't think anyone actually achieves it, and yet we feel positive that other women somehow have. Someone somewhere mentioned it as a possibility, their opinion, mind you, and the media seem to latch on. So when we feel off balance and are struggling to keep all our balls in the air, we assume it's just because we haven't figured out work-life balance. It becomes one more thing we're failing at as moms. Work-life balance. Its description implies that those two things live in harmony, perfectly divided up on the scale of your life. My work and home life have never, ever been balanced evenly on any level. And the truth is, many of my guests have said that rather than trying to have this perfect balance, it's really more about trying to be present in whatever role you're in at that moment. So if you're with your kids, you try to be as present as you can be and involved as you can be. When you're at work, you try to dive right into that. And that to me seems like a much healthier approach to juggling the numerous roles that we as women face. So in the future, instead of asking a particular question about balance, what I'll try to do is get a guest's, you know, opinion and idea on how they manage their numerous roles. So without further ado, let me introduce Dr. Mimi Knoll. Dr. Miriam Knoll is a board-certified radiation oncologist. She is an international invited lecturer speaking about social media in medicine, women in medicine, and medical education. Her writing has been featured in the Huffington Post, Mishpacha, and the Jewish Press, to name a few. She is also a Forbes contributor. Dr. Knoll lives with her physician husband and four sons in Woodmere, New York. Mimi, welcome to the show. Hi, Mimi. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is a very different topic, or where I'm interviewing someone who has a kind of a different career path than what I've been doing till now, which is more in the creative field. And I'm fascinated to know all about it and how you got into it. So for listeners who don't know, you are a radiation oncologist. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, you said that right.
Okay. So can you tell us a little bit about how you chose medicine and why specifically the field of oncology?
Sure. So I come from a family of physicians. Three out of my four grandparents were Holocaust survivors. And my grandfather, when he was in the DP camp in Sweden, was already teaching himself English, came off the boat, as they say, went straight to Brooklyn College, got a PhD, master's, wanted his children to be educated. And what that meant was that my mother is a physician, my mother is a pediatrician, Dr. Hannah Gelfish in Brooklyn. Wow. Her brother is a physician. My father is a physician. His brother's a physician. And we have other cousins and uncles. So when I was deciding what to major in college, my father always encouraged us to take the sciences just because, you know, he thinks it's fascinating and this, you know, great part of your education. And then, you know, I did well, thankfully. And then when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, I was deciding between either psychology, I was going to go for a PhD or a master's, or medicine. And like I said, my parents are physicians. I grew up in a house with their offices, you know, in the basement and on the first floor. And my parents were very, very encouraging. So I went for it without realizing how difficult it would be. But and once I was in medical school, you know, there's lots of different options. And I'll be honest, I did not like anything. And it was getting towards the end of my third year of medical school when you
decide
what you're going to do. And my last rotation was medicine, which is just general internal medicine. And I remember thinking, okay, if I don't like this, I'm just not going to do a residency because I wasn't going to just do it. But then I heard about radiation oncology from two people, from my husband who had met Dr. Gedreman, who I now work with, met him in shul, and my father-in-law who was a urologist, and my husband's also a doctor, so yeah, so there's even more doctors. So my father-in-law is a urologist and he treats prostate cancer very often together with a radiation oncologist. So he told me about it, and when I heard about it, I was like, this is fascinating, this is perfect, this is exactly what I would love to do. So I did it, and I love it.
Wow. What in that particular field spoke to you? I'm just curious because...
Yeah, sure, sure. So oncology is fascinating because you really get to... Well, there's many reasons. Number one, you really get to develop a close relationship with your patients, especially as a radiation oncologist, because patients who come for radiation usually come every day, Monday through Friday, 5 days a week for a couple of weeks. So you really develop a close relationship. And as we know, today with the corporatization of medicine, you know, very often it's in and out, run to see the next patient. And you know, with primary care, that's difficult. And I want to have the opportunity to spend a long time with my patients without, you know, having other things like, you know, your manager telling you, hurry up, you know, we can't keep our lights open if you don't see more patients.
Right.
And then in general, you know, cancer as a disease is fascinating. Humankind has always been suffering from cancer as long as we know. There's actually even a mummy that they've done x-rays of, and they saw that he suffered from prostate cancer. So cancer has been around a very, very long time. Radiation is a fascinating way to treat cancer. You know, we get to use these really high technology, you know, brand new type of machines with very cool technology in physics, and it's very artistic and creative. I work with a team, so you know, I am in charge, so to speak, and I oversee everything that happens to patients under my care, but I work with other professionals like medical physicists, radiation dosimetrists, radiation therapists, nurses. I work with other oncologists, which are very collaborative, which I really, really enjoy.
Wow. So there definitely is a creative side, which one would not normally think of when it comes to this field.
Yes, absolutely. So first of all, everything that we do, so radiation is it's basically x-rays, okay? So it's high-energy x-rays, and there's a whole physics behind it in how radiation is created and then designed for each patient. So what we do is before radiation starts, you know, once I see a patient in consultation and review their records and talk to other doctors and decide if they need radiation and what type. So the first step is to do a simulation, which is a special CAT scan. Mm-hmm. And then we get the patient in the position that they'll need to be in for their treatment. So we may need to make a special mold for them or a special mask or a special cushion. And then we use the CAT scan to actually draw out what we're going to treat. So I actually sit there with my mouse on the computer and draw the areas, and that's a very creative process. And yes, I mean, there certainly are guidelines and general things, you know, how do you treat a breast cancer, how do you treat a prostate cancer, but there's definitely a creative component to it. And when you're done, you definitely feel like, oh, we've accomplished something. You can look at it, you can, you know, say like, hey, we did that. So that's great.
Sure. So I'm sure you witnessed and experienced, you know, numerous emotions in your line of work. There's the hope and optimism and really helping someone. And I'm sure often there are times where there are more challenging situations that you have to deal with, pain, loss. That's pretty tough and emotionally difficult. How do you deal with all those complex emotions?
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of emotion. So, you know, definitely the emotions that people would expect a physician to have in relation to are their patients, right? So we have patients, I have patients that get cured who do really well, who have no side effects from radiation and, you know, are really, really happy. And, you know, they come back every year and, you know, you just want to hug and kiss them because you're so happy. And yes, we do that too. You know, and then there are patients who, you know, don't do so well, or, you know, either they don't do well in the future at some point, or when I meet them, they're already dying from their cancer. And that's really, really difficult. And then there's all these other emotions that are related to do my job. You know, there are coworkers and, you know, other team members, and there are other doctors that I work with. And then there are, you know, just other things related to cancer care. There are insurance companies. Like, I would say one of the things that I most, you know, very commonly, I would say most commonly deal with that's outside of cancer care, but very integral to it, is dealing with insurance companies. You know, getting on the phone with someone from an insurance company and fighting with them, literally fighting with them, because they don't want to pay for a scan that I'm recommending for my patient. And this is actually across medicine now. You know, everyone will hear that their insurance company denied it, or, you know, or I'll prescribe a medication and the insurance company won't want to pay for it. So there's a lot of frustration involved, and that can be difficult. But, you know, how do we deal with it? Really, I would say that social media has really helped. And this is something that I've written about, where, you know, connecting with other physicians really, really makes a difference. And I'm active on Twitter and on Facebook and many oncology, you know, Facebook groups and doctor Facebook groups. And, you know, when you meet other people who are going through the same thing, you know that, you know, fighting the good fight, you know, is something that not only you have to do, but we all have to do. And it's hard, and hopefully change is coming.
Yeah. So essentially, it's about having a support group and a sounding board where you can process these emotions.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people share tips about, you know, how do you run your clinic and how do you write your notes? You know, these are the nitty gritty things. But as a physician, like, we all have parts of our job, no matter what you do, that are, you know, just, you know, get things done and organize it. And, you know, the stuff that isn't the fun stuff, but you got to do it to maintain, you know, the things that you do really enjoy doing. And certainly I would say most doctors really enjoy the patient contact the most, but there's certainly a lot of other stuff that we have to do.
Sure.
And even, you know, God forbid when I lose a patient, you know, a few months ago, I lost a patient who, again, when I met her, I knew she unfortunately had an incurable cancer, but when the patient actually passes away and the patient, you know, grabs onto your hand and says, "Doctor, I want to live." You know, it's like, what do you say? You know, like, that's so, so difficult. And I know you don't have an answer, because we want, you know, you to live too. And how do you say that? And
yeah.
I remember thinking, okay, I'm going to go into my Facebook group and post it. And I was like, you know what? I know what they're going to say. Because I remember the week before, a friend of mine, you know, a virtual friend, that had posted about losing a patient. And everyone just responded like, you know, make sure to take time to process it. You know, it's okay to grieve, you know, talk, you know, with, you know, your friends. And, you know, again, it's not about sharing, you know, personal information. Sure. That's illegal, but it's about, you know, we're human and we care about our patients a lot, and it's just hard. So we have to grieve too.
Yes, absolutely. Do you think this has given you a different perspective on things when you see other people complain about the nitty-gritty details after, you know, experiencing a day at work? Does it sometimes make you think, wow, you know, what's really important in life is health? And how do you view that in general?
So it's a good question. So I think there's two things. Number one is there are definitely many, many oncologists that, like, you know, their kid has a headache and they're like, oh my gosh, it's a cancer, my kid is dying. You know, like, there are many oncologists where, you know, anything happens and they're like, oh no, that's it. You know, like, crisis. I don't generally think that way at all. So in that case, I would say I'm a little more unusual in this sense. Maybe I'm just more practical, or I'm lucky I don't have that sort of PTSD or whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
You know, in terms of, you know, appreciating every moment, you know, it's hard. I would say that it's still definitely a daily commitment that I have to be in the moment. And I would definitely credit my husband, Dr. Abe Knoll, Avraham Knoll. He's an interventional radiologist, and he always tells me, like, don't forget, like, you're living now, you know, which, and even in medical school, you know, because my personal experience of having been married, going through, you know, pre-med, medical school, residency, I've been in practice now for a number of years, that process of always being on the go and running and waiting for the next step and getting to the next goal, then having the next goal open up and, you know, sprinting, always, always sprinting, that has been most of my life that I remember it as an adult. So, you know, the oncology aspect of it has been, I would say, a few years, because my personal experience has always been running, 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 running. So,
right.
On the one hand, you know, the people that I deal with every day are stuck in a very, very difficult moment that's overtaking everything else. But as an individual, I've always been pushing and running and to the next step. And it's certainly a daily commitment to remind myself, I'm living now, you know, take the moment now. And I would say with kids, especially, like watching my kids grow up, my oldest just turned 11, which is
unbelievable,
on Sunday. And, you know, raising him versus my youngest is now, you know, 21 months. Like, it's so much easier to appreciate him at his stage, and he's literally destroying my house. But, like, I'm able to stop and smile and say, okay, this is hysterical. He's a lunatic. But, like, this is funny. And then I'll clean it up and, you know, try not to get annoyed.
Sure.
You know, because you realize there's no stage that lasts. Like, every stage in your life ends and moves on to the next one. So
yeah, absolutely. So you, I think you had mentioned that you'd gone to medical school right after you got married.
Yeah. So I got married in the first year of medical school in November. We actually got engaged in June, and I started medical school in August, and then we got married in November. That was a long engagement because it was either get married right before medical school or at the first break, which was Thanksgiving. So that was November.
Wow. And then you had kids along the way through your medical school and residency.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So my oldest was born at the end of my second year of medical school. And so when I started medical school and I was a first year, my husband was applying and he got into, thankfully, the same medical school, which if you know any doctors, you know, is an amazing thing, because nobody cares if your husband is in another country or doesn't get in or doesn't get into the same school. So it was great that we were able to go together. So when my oldest was born, I took a year off, and then my husband caught up to me. So we did third and fourth year together. And when I came back after the year, I was pregnant with my second. So I gave birth in my third year of medical school, which was during rotations. And then my third was born when I was a resident, and my fourth when I was an attending.
Okay, Mimi, this is beyond impressive. I have no words I don't even know how you managed it. Can you tell us a little bit about that? There must have been challenges or must have been criticism. It's not a common field that many religious women go into, right? Especially when they have young children. How did you go about it?
Yeah. So first of all, I always say there's never a good time to have a baby. And I don't say that as a doctor. I say that as a mother. Okay. And then other people say, oh, that's terrible. You can't say that. It's always a good time to have a baby. And I say, no, it's always a bad time. So I guess, again, I consider myself an experienced mother at this point. So I like to give unsolicited advice, which is that, you know, the first 3 months when you give birth, it's just like a blur. It's like total disaster. It's like, don't make any decisions. Don't take anything personally. You know, no fights can be remembered. You know, you just have to get through it. It's like the first 3 months is like a total blur. And this is whether or not you're nursing part-time or all the time or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's whether or not you're working too. But, you know, thank God. I always, you know, felt very lucky that I had healthy pregnancies where I was physically able to stay in school. You know, there, and I said this throughout my training and even now, like the fact that I was able to complete my training, get to where I am, is a huge bracha, because there are so many reasons why I would have quit.
Sure.
You know, whether it's issues with pregnancies or family or children, or there's just so many things that happen in people's lives. So thank God. Each one is different, you know? So like after my oldest, I took a year off. That was honestly a very hard decision because I had a lot of pressure both my own pressure from inside and pressure from other people who, of course, are always well-meaning, you know, family, friends, or, you know, family and friends and people in school and whatever. But like, it's like, hey, if you take off, are you ever going to go back? Like, maybe I'm just taking off, you know, because there's always that question when you're in medical school, and certainly my position where I went to Beis Yaakov, so it wasn't particularly common. And again, even though my mother was a doctor,
right?
Still nothing, not that much has changed. So people were always like, why are you doing this? Like, you know, when I got engaged, it was like, you know, you don't have to go to medical school. So I took that year off, and I'm so happy that I did. And I did go back. When my second was born, I actually took a week off, went back, finished my rotation, which was 2 weeks. And then I had 6 weeks. And then I had 6 weeks off. So it was like a delayed. And it was crazy. I remember I had full-time help, and then I got a night nurse. And then my night nurse and my full-time help weren't getting along. So I had to get rid of the night nurse. And it was like, again, it was just like sprint, like just get through it. Because I knew that if I didn't go back right away and finish my rotation, I would have had to make up the whole entire thing. So,
right.
And then my third, I took off 5 weeks. And I was also like, how much time should I take off? Am I going to have to extend my residency? You know, am I able to graduate on time? Like, there's so many issues that come up. And I have to say that the struggles that I had giving birth as a trainee are pretty much the same across the board for all women in medicine, regardless of background, religion, frumkeit.
Interesting.
And it's something that, it's just fascinating to me because it's very unusual for medical students give birth, but it's becoming more common in residency. And mm-hmm. I very often see in these physician-only Facebook groups that I'm in, people post, usually anonymously because they're afraid of retribution, and they ask questions like, when should I tell my program director that I'm expecting a baby? You know, am I going to have to extend my training? Again, these are big questions because people have hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, right? And then if you have to extend your training, then, you know, maybe your husband has a job, or, you know, there's so many, it's real life, you know, even though
right.
as a resident, you're still sort of a student, so you don't really have control over your own life. So that's why people post anonymously. And I'm hoping that these movements, you know, this social media revolution, as I like to call, especially for women in medicine, will help, you know, the organizations, the national organizations like the ACGME and the AAMC, which govern medical students and trainees, will make a maternity leave policy. Because I would say that the most difficult part is not knowing who to tell,
sure.
when to tell, what's going to happen, you know, what's expected. And for every single student and resident to go through the same questions individually is just such an incredible amount of stress. And it's not acceptable anymore. It's not acceptable that today in 2019, each student should be worried about getting pregnant and giving birth and her training. And it's not any better than it was 30 years ago. It's just not acceptable anymore. And it's only because, you know, medical students and residents are so regulated and have so little control that it continues to be this way. So it's just interesting that my experience being from is probably not that different. It was just that I was giving birth, and anyone else in my situation would also have had a very hard time dealing with it.
Yeah, it's unusual, especially for, you know, we live in the United States of America. I come from Canada, yep. where there are much better laws. Yeah, there's maternity leave. I think women teachers get a year off. You have this in European countries like Denmark. So it's very strange that we have not yet caught up and offer a better system for the women.
Yeah. And I was watching a documentary recently, I'm forgetting the name, but it went through the maternity leave policies in the United States and, you know, in the Netherlands. And it showed that basically that the change that came about in the Netherlands was because they started promoting paternity leave or parental leave. And it showed how basically we need the fathers to step up and say, yeah, I'm also going to take off. I'm also going to stay home. And it was really only then that that became more socially acceptable for women to take off. It's definitely a huge problem in medicine. I would say that, you know, I mentor a lot of students and residents, and I try to remind them that ultimately you have to do what's best for you. And the same thing with maternity leave. So, you know, there are times where I took off more time, there are times where I took off less time, but, you know, every pregnancy is different, every life stage is different, and you know, no one is going to tell you what's best for you, and you have to take the time that you need and fight for the resources that you need at the time when you need it. And that's really, really uncomfortable, but mm-hmm. you have to do it. And you'll always look back and be happy that you advocated for yourself.
Absolutely. I think especially in Orthodox circles, there's this very strong cultural social norm of the mom being home all the time, or even if she works, she's still somehow supposed to be home all the time.
Yeah. Did you read that article, The Myth of the Haredi Superwoman?
No, I haven't read it.
Oh,
where was
gosh.
That?
Okay, I'll have to send it to you. It was on a new publication. I think I saw it on Facebook. I'm forgetting, but it was fascinating. And it basically showed how the myth of the Haredi Superwoman, this was specifically in Israel, so I get it's a little bit different here, but this idea that even though the father in Kollel is only starting to learn after he takes the kids to school and very often comes home during lunch to feed his own children and, God forbid, maybe even cooks for the children and then picks up the kids from school and is home and maybe even, God forbid, cooks or feeds the kids until the Haredi mother comes home, right? But he cannot acknowledge the help that he gives, nor can his wife acknowledge that she's receiving help. But, you know, bottom line, isn't that interesting? But no matter, the bottom line is the number of hours that he is doing housework or, you know, helping the family is a significant amount of time.
Yeah. It's
but yeah,
really
but again, the acknowledgement of the help that he gives and she receives, or again, some people might say, no, he's not helping her. He's, you know, supporting the family as he should. He's, you know, call it whatever you want.
Yeah.
But that can't be acknowledged. That takes away from the superwoman myth. Isn't that amazing?
It's really, really interesting. Do you think that in a sense we are running ourselves ragged, and does that affect our health? Because we're talking about health, and I keep reading these articles about women who in their 30s and 40s start getting, you know, autoimmune issues. And are we doing something wrong here?
Okay. So there's a lot of things and
that's
sure
a very broad question.
Yeah. So do I think that we're running ourselves ragged? Very often, yes.
Okay.
And I think that's probably because there's so many options. You know, there's so many choices of things. It used to be like, you make Shabbos. Now you can make, you know, a Pinterest Shabbos, an Instagram Shabbos. You could forget about making challah. You can make challah or you could really make challah, you know? And then it's like, you know, you could work or you could work like this, or you could be a stay-at-home. You know, there's so many different ways to be. And instead of acknowledging and appreciating and being grateful for having choices, people who don't really mindfully choose how they want to live their life. And again, that may not be your life forever, but at least in the current stage, you know, or even just today or this week or this month, if you're looking for guidance from the outside world, you're going to run yourself ragged because you're always going to feel guilty that you haven't done the other thing and you can't do everything. And even within the role that you've chosen for yourself, you can't do quote everything. If you're a stay-at-home mother and that's what you chose, not only do you have the opportunity to feel guilty about not working or not working full-time, not having a career, you have an opportunity for not being as good as a stay-at-home mother as somebody else. So there's just so many different cues and rules about how to be that, yeah, I think many people run themselves ragged about not being able to do everything that someone is telling them to be, and all those things are mutually exclusive. I think there are some people out there who the opposite, they don't run themselves ragged. I think there are a lot of people out there that are actually bored. And that may sound crazy.
Nope.
But think about it. Yeah, okay. So and I hear this a lot from women, and I've only started hearing it more recently when I, you know, joined Instagram and started talking about this. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of women reaching out to me saying, you know, they wish they could work, or they wish that they did work, or they wish that they had a career. And I sort of tell them, like, you know, you have your whole life ahead of you, like, go do it, you know? And then people are like, well, what are my kids? And honestly, yes, there are many reasons why people choose to do what they do, but for some people in some situations, it's because they're afraid of failure and they're afraid of making a change and they've decided to do something and it's hard.
Interesting.
And it's hard to make a difference and it's hard to put yourself out there. Listen, in my line of work, I'm also always making decisions and deciding what I want to do and do I apply for this? Do I reach out to this doctor? There's always an opportunity to be afraid of failure because that's part of life. So I think while there are some women who run themselves ragged trying to do too much, I think there are many other women who don't try to do enough. And I think that if they took the risk of being afraid of failure and they actually went out there and looked for something or put themselves out there and tried to reach for a dream, it doesn't need to be something huge, like I want to be an astronaut. It doesn't have to be I want to go to medical school. It could be I want to spend 2 hours a week painting.
Yes.
Or I want to volunteer for this organization. I want to do this and this chesed. I want to invite my neighbor over without worrying that my meal isn't perfect. There are so many ways that we can push ourselves. And by people not doing that, they're bored.
I couldn't agree more. It's funny, we have a lot of listeners who are not working women per se. They don't have a 9-to-5 job, but they have come up to me and said they really love the podcast. A lot of them have different hobbies like painting and volunteering. Some of them want to go back to school when their kids are a little older. So I think this idea of just women really owning their life, finding their passion, and going for it is really key in whatever that is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know what? Like when you talk to people, you learn things, you know, there are so many women out there doing beautiful things, you know, stocking the Bikur Cholim room, you know, driving people to doctor's appointments, visiting sick people, you know, and I almost feel like we need to be, well, not I almost feel like, I do very strongly feel that as a community, we need to be more vocal and acknowledge these chasadim that women are doing.
Because
I honestly think by focusing exclusively on SNEAS, we're really doing our community and our women a disservice.
You know, we need to do a whole other podcast interview on that. Maybe you're coming back for round two.
Absolutely. But I'm just going to throw my plug in there. And this is I came up with it one day, but I feel strongly about it. You know, not everything is about SNEAS. SNEAS is great. Don't get me wrong. I'm wearing sheetal. I dress modestly. But, you know, could we talk about chesed? Could we talk about all the amazing things that women are doing to help their communities that have nothing to do with SNEAS, that have nothing to do with philanthropy? Yes, of course. Hosting an event in your house and raising thousands of dollars. That's beautiful. It's great. It's a party. How about getting down and dirty and doing something? And there are so many women doing this, and we need to acknowledge them, and we need to make these opportunities more formal so that more people can be doing them.
Oh, so true.
I'm glad you agree.
I can't stop nodding. It needed to be said. So one of the special things that you do particularly is you are the president of JOMA, which is Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association.
Yeah, so
I don't know how you have the time, but it really seems like an incredible organization. Can you tell us a little bit about it and how you got started in that?
Sure. So Eliana Fine is a medical student at Stony Brook, which is a medical school in New York, and she and I met through Instagram. And Eliana had this idea to make an event, start an organization, and you know, asked me to help. She asked me to speak at the event. And initially we figured, okay, you know, what would we think would be, you know, a nice turnout? We're like, okay, if 10 people come, that will be, you know, that'll be great. That'll be really, really nice. Meanwhile, you know, Eliana started, you know, talking to people, sharing the information, you know, gathering a board of directors, advisory board, you know, it just blew up. Eliana built a website in a day. Shared the event information. We sold out in 4 days. We had over 100 people. Yeah, and like we would have had more. We turned down so many people, but we already had the space. It was at Traditions in Cedarhurst. And the event like blew up, and the organization blew up. We're less than 2 months old. And it's surprising that our organization is necessary in the sense that, you know, how many from female physicians do you think there are? And the answer is there are quite a few of us. You know, we're busy just like everyone else is busy. How often does any mother get together with their friends? And again, this is not just for mothers. You know, many from female physicians or physician trainees are not married. This is really just for from women doctors. And we also had pre-med students from college and high school come. And we hope that our organization will help connect people, promote from women who want to be doctors either now or in the future. And, you know, also use our skills and our experience to help the community. So we're very involved now in the measles outbreak. So there's an event coming up on Monday held at the atrium in Muncie, and one of our physicians is going to be speaking there about it. We're starting a measles hotline, an initiative where anyone can call our hotline and schedule a physician to come to their house. Wow. And give them a free vaccine. We're trying to help because we feel that we have expertise and we want to help people. And, you know, we're from this community, so we want to do whatever we can to help.
Sure, sure. So you have this on top of your job. You are a mom to young children. How do you practice self-care? And everyone always says, oh boy, don't ask me that one.
No. So I really feel, I love the question. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I feel that my whole life is myself. My whole life is me.
Love that.
And I try not to compartmentalize too much because it just really takes away from being able to do each thing well. And do I really feel like when I'm at work, that's not family time? Like, why am I working, right? And it's not, working is not just about money, right? It's about, you know, I'm doing this because I think this is good for my life. It's good for my family. And therefore, I'm going to continue to do it. So it's the same thing with, you know, cooking supper or, you know, going out to eat or, you know, when I'm going to get my manicure. Actually, right now, I don't have a manicure. I usually do, but I haven't gone recently. And again, because, you know, I prioritized other things over the last couple of days or, you know, 2 weeks. So, you know, it's about prioritizing. It's about prioritizing every day, every moment. I spend tremendous amounts of time organizing my schedule. Not because I'm a very organized person, because I have to organize my schedule. If I want to make it to work, that means I need to leave to work at a certain time, which means I need to go to sleep at a certain time, right? So, yeah. You know, I don't have anything unique or special to say other than, you know, what other people say, which is that, you know, do what makes you happy. And if you're doing something that doesn't make you happy, you need to stop and ask yourself, why am I doing this? And I know people say they have to do something because XYZ fill in the blank, you know, they have to work because you have to pay tuition, or they have to work because they can't, you know, stay home. Or do what makes you happy. And if it doesn't make you happy, you have to stop and ask yourself why and fix that problem. And it's not easy, but you have to do it because you have one life to live. And you also, no matter how old you are, you have your whole life ahead of you.
Yes.
So just because you made a decision and you're already 30 or 40 or 50 or 60, you have your whole life ahead of you. So you have to stop and do it. And that's how I practice self-care. I practice self-care by taking care of myself, which is my life. Someone has to take care of your life, and that can only be you. No one is going to tell you, you should have done this, you should have done that. Only you can stop and tell yourself, I am no longer doing this. I am going to do something else.
Right. It's about being really intentional about your choices, your time, what you choose
Absolutely.
To do, not having to do something. Yeah.
Absolutely. There is almost nothing that you have to do? Almost nothing.
Right.
You know, and people say, I have to cook for Shabbos. Really? Let's say you are stuck in a snowstorm and you didn't get home in time for Shabbos. What would happen?
Right.
I don't think it's a good idea to live in an emergency basis where everything's an emergency. But let's say there really was an emergency. What would happen? Well, you have choices.
Yeah.
You always, always have choices. You know, people say the tuition problem. Again, you know, thankfully, you know, I'm a physician. I make enough money where I can pay for childcare. You know, there are people who they have a job where the childcare is more expensive than what they get paid. So again, I'm not saying you need to quit your job today. What I'm saying is, you know, take control, make a plan how you're going to get to where you want to get to. Just living life day to day, waking up, fetching and saying, you know, I have to go to work, but I don't want to. I have to go to work, but I don't want to. You know, you got to move away from that mindset because that's toxic to your own happiness, to your own life. You know, maybe you're going to continue working until you pay your loans off and then you're going to move somewhere where there's less tuition burden, or you're going to speak to your husband and you're going to take turns, or yeah, there's so many creative ways to live your life. And, you know, saying I have to, I don't buy it and neither should you. That's in my brain. That's what I tell people.
Yes, it's true. Being in victim mode never helped anybody. Really?
I know. I have an example of it in my own life. You know, I was living in Passaic for almost 10 years and we loved it there. Mm-hmm. And we lived down the block from my in-laws. We had amazing friends there. And, you know, it came a time where my husband and I were talking. We were actually in Orlando over Pesach at that time. That year we were with my husband's family. Everyone was there. And we were sort of like, hey, you know, we sort of realizing like all my husband's siblings are moving to the Five Towns and one of my sisters was there. And we said like, hey, you know, we should really move there. Right. That was really, really hard. I had a great job. It was a 14-minute commute door to door, 14 minutes. You know, I was really happy. My husband was just starting to look for a job because he had an extra year of fellowship. So he finished a year after me. But we made a decision. We think this is the right thing for our family. We're going to move. And what was I going to do? How was I going to commute? Where was he going to look for a job? We just did it. And it was June. It was right. June. So, and we wanted to get our kids into the same school that all my nephews were in, because my kids were already in, I think, third and fourth grade.
Mm-hmm.
It was, and then when we did move, we found a rental, which is impossible to find in the Five Towns. We moved. I remember a few months later looking back thinking, that was so hard. But like, we just didn't think about it because we made a decision and we did it. And we very easily could have said, no, we're settled. We have a house. Our kids are happy. We had no reason to move. Zero reason to move. We're really happy. But we decided this is what we think is best and we just did it. And was it easy? No, it was very hard. But we did it.
Wow. That's really the way to do it, I have to say. Just go for things, but it's easier yeah. said than done, of course.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
But it really is, it's something that I think is becoming more and more talked about. I think Brené Brown always brings in this idea of being, you know, courage to be vulnerable and failure is okay, but just try things, get out of your comfort zone. I have to stop talking about her because I always mention her, but it really is great that there's like this shift in our narrative about not being so frightened all the time, making choices, being in charge of your life.
I'm important. Obsessed with Brené Brown. Obsessed. My friend Tamara Scheinfeld recommended that I read the book a few years ago. And yeah, and I read it actually right when I was starting to practice. And it made all the difference because every time I was scared, I realized, oh, that's not a reason not to do it. You know,
that's the reason to do it.
Exactly, exactly. But you know, we're so used to taking our emotions seriously that it really has made all the difference. I'm a huge fan.
Sure.
And also, I'll put a plug out there for another sort of similar. I don't know if you heard of the Life Coach School, Brooke Castillo. Brooke Castillo, she has an excellent podcast. It's
called
the Life Coach School podcast, and she talks a lot about that also. And I mean, you know how it is. I mean, I could see you're like me, you like this kind of stuff. But there are some people who make fun. It took me a while before I
right.
was willing to share,
sure.
so to speak. But I'm a huge fan of her work, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah,
and I'll make sure like me who has a long commute.
Yes, yes. And I'll make sure to include the Brooke Castillo in the show notes for listeners to look up.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'll ask you one more question before I get to our favorites. I could really ask you 20 more questions, but
Another time.
I'm keeping out for time. Is there a particular area in women's health that is often ignored and you wish, you know, something that you want to bring awareness to? As women, we tend to take care of our family and put our health, you know, second. So yeah. Is there something out there that you kind of want to talk about?
I'm going to be really boring and I'm going to say, go get a mammogram.
Okay.
It's shocking to me because there are still women who have insurance who don't go for their mammogram. So go for your mammogram. It's really, really important. It's the best tool that we have. Very often women with dense breasts also
yes.
need to get an ultrasound at the same time. That's something that, you know, each woman should discuss with their doctor. Certainly, if someone has a family history of cancer, they may fall under, you know, a high-risk category and may need MRI, you know, mm-hmm. breast MRI for screening. But these are the best tools that we have. I'd say the same thing with colonoscopy. Again, you know, I feel like sometimes people get so focused on, you know, how healthcare doesn't work, but there are unfortunately too many people who don't even do the things that we know work well.
Yes.
So, you know, going for a mammogram, going for a colonoscopy, going for a skin check, a skin screening with a dermatologist, you know, going for a pap smear. These are things that, you know, every person should be doing.
Yeah. And I just want to shout out to listeners. This is not an age specific thing. I recently had a mole removed and I had years ago that were both borderline yeah. melanoma, and I stay out of the sun and I'm fairly yeah. healthy and young. So people yeah. kind of tend to think, oh, when I'm old and falling apart, I'm going to take care of myself.
100%. 100%. Every adult, you know, should have a physician. When you're a kid, you have a pediatrician. When you stop going to your pediatrician, you start going to an internist. It's really, really important. And even if it's just to, you know, say, hey, you're great. Keep doing what you're doing. Come back in a year. Do it. It's so, so important because when something comes up, you have someone to help you.
Yes. So, Mindy, what are you most proud of in your career?
So, I am most proud of in my career making the change from feeling that my life, as people would call it, but again, I don't like calling it that way, but you know, my family life, my background, my Frumkite, you know, for many years, I felt that held me back, mm-hmm. made it more difficult for me to succeed in my career. And I'm very proud that I've been able to turn that around. I've been able to now realize that all my life stuff makes me a better doctor and better in my career. I've been able to do research on the subject of women in medicine and parenthood in medicine. I've been able to advocate for other women doctors. I'm actually going to a conference this weekend in Chicago. It's the biggest cancer conference in the world. It has over 40,000 oncologists who come. And because of my advocacy work, that's another story for another time, I got them to now offer on-site childcare. So anybody
oh,
can
wow.
bring their baby to the conference and have childcare for free. That was because of advocacy work that I did. So, you know, I've been able to really realize that me being a real person with a real personality and real interest and a real life makes me a better doctor in everything that I do.
Sure.
And that includes taking care of my patients better. Because again, I understand them. I understand where they're coming from. I understand that they have a life. I understand that the cancer is part of who they are and part of how they're living their life. And that helps me take care of them in a better way.
Wow. Maybe we're down to our favorites. This is fun. This is where I ask you a couple of your favorite things. So
sure.
We'll start with your favorite book.
My favorite book, I would say, is Daring Greatly. We just spoke about Brené Brown, so that's on my mind.
My favorite, too.
Yeah, awesome.
Do you have a favorite girl boss or role model?
My mother. My mother is a pediatrician. My mother never complained, never thought it was strange or unusual. Wow. You know, wake up, go downstairs to the basement, be a doctor, come back upstairs, make supper. Like it was no big deal. Still doesn't think it's a big deal at all.
Do you have a favorite easy meal or dinner? And it could be takeout.
Sure. Yeah. Well, takeout's always fun. I would say the easiest meal is tacos because, yeah, you know, you make the taco meat. It's super fast. It's delicious. You have, you know, the tacos. You have corn. I usually make corn on the cob, a little salad. It's great. Everyone loves it. Everyone's happy.
Great. It's so funny. I recently just interviewed Danielle from Peas, Love, and Carrots. And she said, am I allowed to say takeout as like a favorite easy meal? I'm like, of course, Danielle. You're human. You cook all day.
Yes.
It was funny.
I love it.
Last question. What's your favorite way to unwind or just to relax?
My favorite way to unwind is to get a manicure, or pedicure, or massage.
Lovely. Sounds great.
Yeah, I'm usually literally falling asleep at the table and they're like, are you okay? I'm like, yes, I'm okay.
Oh, that's so funny.
I'm like dozing off while I have like my hands out in front of me.
Well, that makes sense, you know?
Yeah. No, I'll be honest. I get plenty of sleep. It's one of my priorities because I just cannot function if I don't get enough sleep. But still, every time I get a manicure, I'm dozing off.
Well, Bibi, thank you so much for joining us today. Can you tell listeners where they can find you or find out more about you?
Sure. So thanks so much for having me. I'm a huge fan of yours. So it's really an honor to be a guest on your podcast. And I am on Instagram at dr.mimi.k. I'm on Twitter at mnoll_md. I'm on Facebook as Miriam Mimi Noll. I have both there because some people know me professionally Miriam versus personally as Mimi. I write for the Huffington Post and for Forbes, and I write for ASCO Connection. So if you use Google, you can find my writing very easily.
Mimi, keep up the great work that you're doing. I can't even imagine how many people will be inspired by this. You really are a role model. So thank you again.
Thanks so much. Have a great day. Talk soon.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening in on our thoughtful, authentic conversation today. Stay tuned for next week's episode and make it a great one.